Most Christians know that Jesus told us that all the Old Testament testifies of Him. The challenge we face is knowing how. How are the stories in Genesis about Jesus? How are we supposed to find Christ in the dark and bloody book of Judges, or the wisdom sayings of Proverbs? To answer all these questions and provide a guide for readers of the Old Testament who are looking for Jesus, I wrote The Christ Key. I'm Chad Bird, and for over three decades, I've been studying and teaching the Old Testament. I wrote The Christ Key for you, so you could unlock all the doors in the Old Testament, step inside, and say to each of them, "Show me Jesus." Visit ChristKeyBook.org to learn more.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you sign up for the Las Vegas event. Here We Still Stand regional event in Las Vegas is 2 days, October 15th and 16th. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people are going to be talking about assurance in Christ. So you know you want to come and hear about that. It's only $65 to hang out with us, hear all the talks, pick some breakouts, and includes your lunch and a whole bunch of other side, you know, snacks, drinks, all the things that we like to do. And so you can get all of that for $65. Go over to the website, click on the event page, and you can sign up. We'd like to see you there. Also, make sure you pick up a copy of Chad's new book, The Christ Key. It's out. It's out and about. I've seen it pop up on social media in people's hands. You don't want to be left out. You want to be able to get that book, get that key. I'll put a link in the show notes. You just click on that link, order it. You know, Amazon gets stuff to you quick, so you can have it by the end of the week. By the time you hear us again, you could have already read that book. So make sure you pick that up. Chad, we left off in a sort of disappointing spot. We had some hope. Looked like there was a plan in place to get David to bring his wayward, murderous son home, and seemed like it was working. You know, so you got Joab putting some words in the mouth of a wise and courageous woman, and then she also improvises some and gets David trapped in his words, and we get excited because David says, "All right, fine, tell Absalom to come on home," and we think we have an Old Testament prodigal son, but then we ended with a kind of downer where Absalom does come home to Israel, but he does not come home, like he's not visiting dad, he didn't come and have dinner with him. It says that David does not want to see him, and so he has to dwell in his own house and does not come into David's presence.
Yeah, it is a letdown of an ending. It's like the parable of the prodigal son. The parable gets home, and the dad's like, "Well, there's a house, the back acre of the 40. You go back there and live. I don't want to see your face." And as we'll see in the upcoming verses, this lasts for a while, and this is the beginning of this real turning point in the life of Israel, because as we are about to see, Absalom is going to become increasingly frustrated. And even when he does see the king, he's not satisfied, because it's a very frigid kind of greeting. And then we'll then see in chapter 15, which we'll get to in a few minutes, the plan that is hatched by Absalom to stage this coup, in which we really have this breakup in the nation of Israel.
You have to wonder if all the terrible things that are going to happen from this point forward, if a lot of them, at least the ones involving Absalom, could have been avoided if this would have went a little more like the prodigal son. You don't know, but you wonder what would have happened if David had ran out of the castle and embraced him, and if David would have remembered that he also is a murderer, and his sin had been put away, and if he had been able to do that the way that God does that, which, by the way, is very difficult for us to do because we're not God. But if all of this is different, you think that, you know, Nathan gives David this prophecy that his house is going to have all this turmoil and all this bloodshed. And, you know, in that way, maybe you tend to think like, oh, well, it's inevitable. But it's not exactly how prophecy works. It doesn't force it to happen. It just foretells it. And David actually is involved. This isn't just David like standing back just sort of uninvolved, just looking at the ramifications of his, of, you know, his sin. David has also failed to learn a couple of things, and he's a participant in the destruction of his family by not responding to certain things the way that he ought to, not responding to the rape of his daughter the way he should have, not responding to Absalom coming home the way that he should have. So he's an active player. He's not sort of just sitting on the sidelines freaking out about something that he can't control. I mean, he is involved in the whole thing.
Yeah, that's a great point to make, especially about the prophecy part. You know, people do kind of get the impression sometimes that if God threatens that A or B is going to happen, then A or B is going to happen. That is not always the case. A great example of that is when God says through Jonah that Nineveh is going to be overthrown. Well, it wasn't. You know, God relented from what he had said. So just because God threatens that something is going to happen through his prophet does not of necessity mean it's going to happen, because people can repent. Things can change. And when they do, God himself makes a change in what he has decided he is going to do. So he didn't overthrow Nineveh. And had David approached this whole situation with Absalom differently, I have no doubt that things would have turned out differently. It's a great reminder for us that, yes, of course, there's a place for judgment and justice. That's part of our lives here in this world. But just imagine how many things could be improved if more mercy, compassion, and forgiveness were shown.
Yeah,
because that is truly life changing.
Well, it's
we know that individually, and we've experienced it all in churches, and even, you know, we have great examples from the last few years where there's been these very public displays of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. On the part of those who have been just tragically harmed and violated. And people are just astonished and taken aback and often offended by these displays of forgiveness. But here's the point. They make news because they're so radically different from what we're accustomed to expect. And I know personally, and I'm sure many, many people listening know personally, that when you receive unexpected mercy and grace and forgiveness from someone that you would never have anticipated receiving it from, that becomes a life-changing event. And it does kind of make one of those unforgettable impacts on you. So, you know, Absalom goes on to do a lot of bad stuff. But if, I think part of why he's doing what he's doing is because he is so angry.
Yeah,
he's angry
at
his dad. Oh, yeah. He's just angry in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's that, I think we brought this up before, and I'll probably get the quote a little bit wrong, but it is that old Robert Capon quote where he says, you know, which has really made a mess of the world? Is it grace, mercy, compassion, forgiveness, or is it hatred, retribution, revenge, vengeance, that sort of thing? And I think we know which of those is making a mess of the world, you know?
Yeah, and it's going to make a huge mess of David's life, Absalom's life, their whole family, and the whole nation is going to be affected by this. So that is a bit of a taste of what is to come. Right away, though, we have to talk about how handsome Absalom is.
Yeah, right. This guy is a real looker.
He would have been on the cover of every Harlequin romance. I mean, yeah. this is the guy. In fact, we're told in verse 25 that in all Israel. So you look at all the Israelites, and nobody was as handsome as Absalom was. From the sole of his foot, I love this description, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was how many blemishes? None.
Yeah, no bunions on the feet, no acne on the face. This guy's got it.
This guy, I mean, perfectly proportioned. Everything is just the way you would. He's like the perfect specimen of male humanity. No blemish whatsoever. Just, you know, all the girls are gonna spot Absalom. And not only that, but he's got great hair.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to bring in the hair. So verse 26, there's a lot of funny verses in the Bible. This one cracks me up every time I read it. Verse 26, when he cut the hair of his head, in the parentheses we have, for at the end of every year, he used to cut it when it was heavy on him. He cut it, in the parentheses. So at the end of every year, he'd cut his hair. And he would weigh the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight, which is about almost 5 pounds. Who weighs their hair?
Yeah, that's wild.
I mean, this is a very, very strange thing. I mean, you get the impression that it's almost like Absalom wrote these verses, right? Yeah, Absalom, you know, it was nobody as handsome as he was. Sole of his foot, top of his head, no blemish in him. He had great hair. It just grew. These lavish locks of hair would grow. And at the end of every year, I mean, he had to cut it. It was getting so long. 5 pounds is what it weighed.
And you might think, like, this seems like an insignificant detail. I mean, it's in here for a reason,
which we'll
discover later. But maybe make a note that Absalom is a guy that has long hair, apparently thick hair, a lot of hair on this guy. He's got, you have to imagine he's got this long, thick, wavy hair. And once a year, he trims it. He doesn't cut all his hair off. He just trims up his hair every year to get it, you know, looking good again, and, you know, cuts 5 pounds of it off. But this man having a lot of great hair will come into the story later.
Yeah. We've encountered these details before, where anytime you have a physical description of a person, almost without exception, it's going to be important to pay attention to it, because it's going to feature later in the narrative. And there's something else going on here too. I suspect that part of the reason the hair is mentioned, not only is this a foreshadowing, to use the literary term, but it's also a backshadowing, because he is pictured as a sort of Samson figure. I mean, you kind of picture handsome Samson, picture him as kind of a handsome guy. He's a big guy. He's got all this hair, and he's out to wreak havoc wherever he goes. So in many ways, you have Absalom presented here as sort of a Samson type figure. In fact, some people think that maybe if he doesn't have a Nazirite vow, there's sort of a play on the Nazirite vow going on here. So, you know, if you're Nazirite, you don't cut your hair. So maybe he took some sort of Nazirite kind of vow. We're not told that, but it's kind of suggested by this emphasis on his hair. And the fact that he's good looking, Saul was described as good looking. David was described as good looking. Now this other royal son is described as good looking. So that makes us wonder, okay, you know, is it going to be more like Saul? Is it going to be more like David? How is this Saul going to turn out? And then after that, we're told that he had 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. So he named his daughter after his sister. And she too was a beautiful woman. We're going to have to return to that later, because we hear in a couple more chapters that he didn't have any kids. So we'll reconcile that when we get to that. That's in chapter 18. Okay, verse 28. So we have a physical description of him, a little bit about his family, a lot about his hair. What happens when he gets back to Jerusalem? He's in his separate house, and we're told, verse 28, Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. So a lot of time passes, and Absalom no doubt is wondering, when is this going to change? Is 2 going to turn into 4 and 4 into 6? How long are we going to have to live in kind of this strange lack of reconciliation with my dad? So he thinks, well, you know, Joab got me back. Maybe Joab can be my go-between. So Absalom goes for Joab so that he can send him to the king and Joab won't come to him, which is a little strange, because Joab worked so hard to get him back. I suppose Joab's thinking to himself, man, maybe I made a mistake, because obviously David was not happy when I got Absalom back, because he won't have anything to do with him. And so now Joab is not returning his calls either.
Yeah, and of course we don't know David is obviously having conversations with Joab, and it could be that, you know, Joab has already been like, you know, you really should probably see Absalom. And David has made it explicitly clear that he is not going to see Absalom. And maybe he's even told Joab, you're not going over there either, because I'm not going to have you devise some kind of trick like you just did to get him here. Like, we're not doing that. I'm not seeing him and you're not seeing him.
So Absalom comes up with a mafia plan. He said the second time Joab wouldn't come. So Absalom says to his servants, hey, I have an idea. You know, Joab, he's got that field that's right next to mine, and he's got a barley crop. Go set it on fire. It's the sky. And this is another, by the way, this is another Samson move. You remember back in the book of Judges that one of the ways that Samson was playing with the Philistines and making them angry and getting back at them, is he got all these foxes somehow and tied their tails together and put a flaming torch on the end of it and sent them these running blow torches through the fields of the Philistines. Well, now this is the same sort of same sort of tactic that Absalom is going to use. So set the field on fire. Now maybe that'll get his attention. So they did, and it worked. Verse 31, Joab got up. He went to Absalom, and he's like, why did you set my field on fire? I suppose he probably already knew this. Absalom said to him, you didn't return my calls.
Yeah.
He's like, look, I sent word saying, come here, that I can send you to the king. And you never answered. And then he goes on, why did I even come home? Why did I come from Geshur? Remember, that was a place where his grandfather was king. And so he was hanging out there after he had to flee. So why did I even come home? It would be better if I just stayed up there, up north. Now I'm just kind of stuck like on house arrest here in Jerusalem. Now, therefore, he goes on, let me go into the presence of the king. If there's guilt in me, let him put me to death. Well, that's a pretty bold move, because Absalom, yeah, there is guilt in you. So
right.
This is you're really setting yourself up here. So if there's guilt in me, let him put me to death. So you can tell pretty obviously that Absalom is at the point where something's got to give here. Something's got to change. So verse 33, finishing out the chapter, Joab did go to the king. He told him, he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and he bowed himself, that is Absalom, bowed himself to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Period. End of chapter. Now, there's a lot we're not told, but there are some suggestions on exactly what the implications of this were and what kind of reconciliation, if you can use that word, this was. Notice that it says that Joab went to the king, and Absalom came to the king, and he bowed before the king, and the king kissed him. It doesn't say anywhere in there it was David. So you would expect that this was a true reconciliation between father and son. They would say something like, you know, he came before David, or he came before his father, and his father kissed Absalom, or something like that. But all the words that are used are regal words, official words. So this is not so much a reconciliation between father and son as it is a king who is finally willing to accept one of his servants being back in town, more right. or less. And he does kiss him, but this kiss does not seem to be the warm and loving kind of kiss that, for example, the prodigal's father gave to him.
Yeah, I would imagine the way this goes is that Absalom sets the field on fire. Joab now has to go to his house and figure out what's going on. And, you know, Joab goes to David and says, okay, look, man, you got to see this guy. He's lighting my fields on fire.
This is getting serious now.
Come on. I mean,
what's he going to do next, right?
Yeah, you got to see this guy. And so David says, okay, but it makes sense. If your hand is forced, like, you can't force somebody to reconcile.
Yeah, that's right.
That's not
right.
How
I'm going to bring these two people together, and I'm going to make them forgive each other.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
It doesn't work that way. No.
And so, yeah, there's nothing that's really changed here.
No. I mean, they're just going through formalities.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like people, you know, they might shake hands, but their other hand's behind their back with a knife in it, basically. This is no true reconciliation. And as we're going to see at the beginning of chapter 15, I think it's pretty clear to Absalom that he realizes this. Because you don't want to read too much into motivations and, you know, what might have been kind of stuff. But because the very next section begins to describe how Absalom was preparing to take over the kingdom, I doubt that would have happened had what we just read about been any kind of real true forgiveness and a bringing back together of father and son. Absalom, yeah. In other words, feels how cold that kiss is from David.
Yeah, I mean, if Absalom is determined to put together a conspiracy to take over the kingdom, and nothing can dissuade him from this, what does he care if he goes and sees his father? Why is he so desperate to get in the presence of his dad? So you have to believe that this is probably an idea that is cooking in Absalom, and almost that he wants to see his father to make sure that he wants to go through with it. Right? I mean, this. Right. Why else would you want to see him? Like, you want to see your dad, figure out Hey, you're sort of giving him a chance to treat you like his son, and that doesn't happen. And so you have, David's had now, I think, multiple opportunities to probably prevent what is about to happen here.
Yeah, yeah. But fails once more. Because, to jump over into the next chapter, so 2 Samuel 15, the first thing we read is that Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now, you don't have to read any further than that to realize that something sinister is brewing. Because if we know anything from previous episodes, or if you want to go all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy, what's the one thing a king is not supposed to do? Not the one thing, but some of the things kings are not to do, they're not supposed to gather chariots and horses. So this has all the trappings of royal ambition here. Absalom gets himself, he's got a chariot, oh, he's got horses, and he got all these cheerleaders, these 50 men who are going to run before him. So Absalom is putting into place his plan. He's going to, first of all, look like a king. He's going to make sure he's got his chariot. He's got the right kind of car to drive. He's going to make sure that he's got the right kind of people around him. He's creating this whole image of who he wants to be. I mean, this is all Instagram kind of stuff going on in the ancient world. He's manipulating images. He's manipulating the background, manipulating the kind of people that he's around to give himself the appearance of someone who's deserving of attention, someone who's deserving of a higher place than he currently has. So he's setting the stage, and we're going to see as we move through the rest of this how Absalom is really, he's kind of a master politician in the worst sense of the term, because he's more or less, he's running for office, but he's, in a way, he's running for office as a demagogue. He's going to appeal to the people's worst, most base interest. He's going to promise everything to everybody. He's creating this whole situation around him where he kind of looks like he deserves to have this. So to read through what he's doing here, it just comes across as if he's a man who has kind of fully gone to the dark side. He is, by this point, he's embraced what he wants to do, and nothing, no one is going to stop him. And he's willing to basically do anything and say anything to get to the place that he wants to be.
Yeah, because you're not going to take the kingdom with a chariot and 50 guys. That's not the point here. The point is to get a chariot and 50 guys to get you to the place where you can get can take the kingdom.
That's exactly what's happening. And here's so he gets that, and then it goes on to say what he would do. He would get up early every day, and he'd go to the gate of the city and stand there. And when people were coming in, if any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, that's the way it would work. In Israel, we saw that, for instance, the wise woman from Tekoa a couple chapters before. You know, she had, it was a fictitious story, but she brought this story before the king so we could pronounce judgment. So that was part of the duty of the king. He was not just a ruler, but he was a judge, kind of like the Supreme Court, I suppose, in one person. So people would go with a dispute to the king for judgment, and Absalom would stop them, and he'd say, "Hey, you know, what city are you from?" And they would say, you know, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe in Israel." So that he would say, you know, "Where are you from?" Engage him in conversation. They'd say, "And I'm from such and such a place in Israel." And I don't know, it's a little ambiguous here. When it says in Israel, does that mean outside of Judah? So like he was especially pinpointing people who were not of his dad's tribe of Judah? Or did he just kind of mean in general? Whichever it was, he's wanting to know, you know, "Where are you from?" And then this is the real stab in the heart. He would say to them, "Oh, well, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "So nobody's going to pay attention to you. You've got a good claim. You've got a good case. You should win. But there's nobody that my father has set up to listen to you." Then he'd go on and say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." Then he goes on, "Whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand, he'd take hold of him, he'd kiss him." Another kissing scene going on. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So, this, to echo what I said earlier, this really is the work of a true demagogue. He's promising everything to everyone. Whatever your case may be, man, you're going to get justice for me, but it's too bad you can't because I'm not in charge. If I were in charge, he doesn't say king, but if I were judge, if I were judge, then I would take care of all of this for you. However, of course, I'm not. So wouldn't it be great if we could somehow alter the situation so that I, good looking that I am and wise that I am and full of justice that I am, I would give you exactly everything that you want.
Yeah, you can hear
worst
it sort
kind
of
politician.
Yeah, you can hear it in this sort of, oh, that I were like this sort of,
oh yeah,
I'm
yeah.
So sympathetic to you. Like, this isn't, I just need power. It's like, man, oh, that I were there. Like, I hear your case. Like, I'm a man of the people.
And that's exactly
it. This is what it is. I mean,
it isn't about me. It's about you. I mean, I would do all this for you.
Oh yeah. He's doing some real populist candidate kind of stuff here. Right. So this is, if you know anything about, like, I don't know, like the fall of Rome, these are the kind of guys that they go to the people, promise them everything, going to fight for their cause, but they got ulterior motives.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. That's precisely what's happening here with Absalom. And it works. I mean, that is kind of the scary part. It works. He steals the hearts of the men of Israel because they believe it. He's lying to them through his teeth, but they believe him.
And this seems this is a pretty hard task. I mean, like, Israel, they really like David. I mean, David was not like an unpopular king. I mean, like, this guy will go down as like the most loved king in all of Israel's history. So Absalom really has to do some work here, and I think that's why it uses this language of stealing. He stole them. It's one thing if you make someone fall in love with you, right? So like, oh, this person fell in love with this person. Oh, great. It's different if you like steal their heart from somebody else, right? Like that's a different thing. And so what Absalom is doing is that he's convincing them that someone that they already do like, he's convincing them that they should like him instead. So yeah, this is an actual job to get done here. It's not like, it'd be different if you were dealing with like this very unpopular king and you just came along being like, oh, this guy's terrible. That won't work. Absalom has to make himself seem better than someone that they already approve of.
Yeah, which tells you just how persuasive he is. So you take a leader today who has an extremely high approval rating, and then you have a candidate who comes up and is able to convince everybody to switch sides. That's the kind of situation that we're going to, just to put it in contemporary terms. So say we've got a president who has a 70% approval rating, which is astronomically high.
Right.
And there's an election coming up in a year, and somehow the opposing candidate is actually able to reverse this to where when it's election time, he's the one who gets the vote to put him in office. That's that kind of situation here. So it almost seems as if Absalom has taken a page from the playbook of David. David's very highly skilled rhetorically. So he was able to always convince people to come to his side or convince him, that A was true when it was actually a lie. He was always able to, either by truth or by cunning, to get people to do what he wanted them to do. Well, Absalom, his son, has obviously inherited that particular trait, but he's using it for evil purposes. And here he's about to play his final card here to put into place his plan of action. So at the end of 4 years, we don't know for sure, is this like the 2 years have passed, this is four more years, or if this is like 4 years in total that he's been back in Jerusalem. Whatever it is, 4 years, Absalom goes to the king again, and he says, please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. So he's wanting to go to Hebron. Now, we'll come back to that in a second, because Hebron is significant here. And he says, your servant, so I vowed a vow while I was living in Geshur in Aram, so when I was in exile, more or less, and I said, here's the vow, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord. So this is a votive offering, that is a vow offering that he's made. And these were pretty common in the Old Testament. You know, is basically you would say to God, if you will do this for me, then I will respond in this sort of way by making this kind of offering. So when he was in exile, he claims, now this is one of these cases in the Bible, and we have many of these, where we're not sure if he actually did this or if he's just completely fabricating the story. I suspect he's completely fabricating the story because, of course, it's serving his selfish interest. But either way, he says to David, I made this vow, and look, you know, it's come true, and so I need to go and fulfill this vow in Hebron. And the king, to his discredit, is once again duped by Absalom. He was duped by Absalom, which led to the murder of Amnon. He was duped by Amnon, which led to the rape of Tamar. And now he once more is being taken in by Absalom because he says to him, go in peace. So he goes to Hebron. Now, why Hebron? Because Hebron, you may remember from the opening chapters of 2 Samuel, Hebron is where David was acclaimed king. So Hebron was the city which was kind of the headquarters. It's a city that's controlled by the tribe of Judah. And Hebron was kind of the headquarters of David. And that was where he was acclaimed king, first by Judah, the tribe of Judah, and then later by all of Israel. So Hebron has these deep David attachments. And it's kind of like Absalom wants to relive his father's life, but in a perverted sort of way. So David was acclaimed king according to the will of God in Hebron. Now Absalom wants to be acclaimed king according to the will of Absalom in Hebron. And then, of course, he's going to go to Jerusalem, just like David went to Jerusalem. So it's sort of an antichrist kind of move, if you want to look at this typologically. So what David did was a pattern for what Christ did. Now what Absalom is doing is a kind of an antichrist sort of move. That is to say, he's doing the exact opposite of what this messianic type would do. So he's going to Hebron, goes there. Verse 10 says that when he sent secret messengers to all the tribes of Israel saying this, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. So he's sent these messengers, these spies, and they're going to kind of get everything ready for what's about to happen. And then he takes 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. I suspect what's happening here is that he gets some influential citizens. I mean, if you're just kind of a regular person, you're probably not going to be invited by the king's son to this great feast and celebration in Hebron. So these are probably leading citizens. Now, they're not complicit in this. They don't know what's going on. But put yourself in David's shoes. David and his advisors realize that Absalom is going to have these 200 probably influential citizens. And when they hear they're staging a coup, what's the assumption they're going to make? That these 200 people are on Absalom's side because they're with him.
Right.
Yeah. And just kind of finish this out, and then we'll talk about some more of these details. While Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, or the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, Gilo, and the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. So, this is kind of the beginning of, not the kind of, this is going to be the beginning of David's, I guess you could say his second exile. Everything is kind of being set up by this. And Absalom is related to all sorts of biblical figures. I mean, whether he's like another Saul who's going to be persecuting David, or whether he's like another Pharaoh who's going to be persecuting the Israelites, whoever he is, Absalom, you can kind of think of it this way. Absalom is everything that Saul thought David was.
Right.
Kind of a good way to put it. So Absalom is, Saul always had this extremely negative view of David. He thought David was conspiring against him. He thought David was going to stage a coup. He thought David was going to take over his kingdom. He thought David was always just out to get him. He was wrong completely, of course, as we've seen. Now Absalom comes along, and Absalom is exactly who Saul always thought that David was. And in that way, he's the darkness to David's light. He's the antichrist to David's messianic kind of significance.
Yeah, it seems that this plot works like this, that, you know, Absalom has to get the appearance. He doesn't actually have you know, all of Israel on his side or anything. He needs it to appear like he's got a significant amount of it on his side, and that he's got certain individuals and certain types of people on his side, so that regular people will say, wait a minute, like, what? I don't want to be on the wrong side of this. It looks like Absalom's really got all the momentum. Looks like this is happening. It's all a ruse that ends up maturing into an actuality because of the way that he sets it up. So he makes it appear as though, if you don't get with me, you're going to be on the wrong side of this. And that makes people get on his side, when in reality, he didn't have that big of a movement to start with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so from a kind of an objective point of view, it's a masterful play. I mean, he's got everything figured out. He's one of these smart guys that's smart in a very, very dangerous sort of way. He's got it all mapped out, planned out. He's got the media events planned, as it were. He's got the impressions that he's going to be giving to everybody. And lo and behold, people, as you say, they're won over to this because they're just taken in by everything. They're like, oh man, it looks to me like everybody is going to Absalom's side. So I want to be on the right side. I don't want to lose my neck. So I guess I will.
Yeah. He's even staging things, like people declaring him king. He's setting these things up to look organic.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, and we got to say something about Ahithophel here. Ahithophel is going to figure largely into the rest of this narrative. So Ahithophel is to David what Judas Iscariot is to Jesus. Ahithophel is a close advisor to David. He is, right there with him. He's one of the guys that is going to advise him. And he's changed sides. Now, why does he change sides? Well, here's a kind of interesting detail. Now, this is not 100% certain because some of the names are a little bit different, but the evidence suggests that Ahithophel is the paternal grandfather of Bathsheba. So Bathsheba's dad is Ahithophel's son. So if you kind of keep that in mind, one of the things we're going to see in the rest of the chapter is the very first thing that Ahithophel counsels Absalom to do is to go onto the roof of the palace, the very roof from which David spotted Bathsheba, and to set up a tent and to bring the concubines of his father, of David, into the tent and to have sexual intercourse with them as a way of claiming that he is now the guy in charge. Now, if you think back to what happened with David and Bathsheba, the location, what he did, the murderous mess that resulted from this, it's as if Grandpa Ahithophel, who had been David's advisor, says to himself, I'm going to get some revenge, and here's the way I'm going to go about it. So he's going to be the one who is instrumental in advising Absalom at first, but as we will see, his counsel will also be rejected at one point. And he will, as a result of this, go home, set his house in order, and hang himself. Now, all of this, as you can already guess, is going to be a prototype of what's going to happen later with Judas Iscariot. So here we have David and Jesus. We have those who are close to them, Ahithophel, Judas Iscariot, and both of them betray, and both of them have the same end. Both of them end up taking their own lives. And there's going to be some other parallels here between events in Holy Week and what's happening here with David. But that's kind of the way this coup all begins. Now, what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter, beginning with verse 13 and so forth, and we'll cover that in the next episode, is that David's going to have to run away. He's got to get out of Jerusalem because he just doesn't have the manpower, or at least the confidence, to be able to meet Absalom. So he would rather go into exile, flee eastward, rather than face his son. So it's kind of one of these, we're going to retreat and regroup and figure out what to do next. And just to kind of give you a teaser for next week, how's he going to leave? When he's betrayed by one of his own, how does he leave? Well, he actually crosses the river Kidron, and then he goes up onto the Mount of Olives, which is just exactly, of course, what happens on the night that our Lord is betrayed as well. So David goes in exile, just like Jesus himself will go into the exile of death for us. So what we're seeing here is a shadowy representation of what's going to come into the light when we get to the Gospels. Some pretty cool typology happening here between 2 Samuel and the Gospel accounts.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's all we got time for today. We will pick it up next week, and we will find out why, man, it would have been a lot more interesting if David had responded to this whole thing differently. I don't know what David's going to do in exile, but this thought has to have crossed his mind that maybe I should have handled this in another way, and I would not be out here on the
road. Situation I'm in. Right, yeah.
But we'll get there next week. We'll see you then.